Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest for this episode, but an excellent one. Danny Parkins is the co-author of Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. He wrote that book with Ben Kaplan, and it is really, really interesting. It's an examination of some of the very well-known people in the NBA. Tom Thibodeau, Frank Vogel, the Van Gundys are prominently featured. Just people who started their basketball journeys in Division III or eventually sort of made a little bit of a name in Division III and how they moved into the NBA. It's really, really interesting. Highly recommend it if you are a basketball junkie. Also, Danny is the co-host of one of the leading Chicago afternoon shows. He's on the Score 670, works with Matt Spiegel. And so we get into sports talk radio in 2024, what he's trying to sort of do as a host, where he sees the business going, what it's like to call big time radio in Chicago. So I think you're gonna enjoy this. Danny Parkins coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, if you are from Chicago or have an affinity for Chicago sports, this gentleman would be quite familiar to you. For this audience, we'll expand it a little bit. Danny Parkins is the author of Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. He co-wrote that book with Ben Kaplan. He is the co-host of the Score 670 in Chicago's afternoon show with Matt Spiegel. And he's here to talk about both his new book and about sports talk radio. And with that, welcome Danny Parkins to the Sports Media Podcast.
Richard, longtime listener, first time guest. Thank you, sir.
I apologize for all the below mediocre content that you've had to listen to over the years, but thank you for that.
I got to say, maybe the most relatable thing about you recently is how you say that your Twitter account is terrible now.
I would say unreadable, quite frankly. I can't even believe anybody. Yeah, so I can't believe it. I can't believe anybody would even listen. All right. By the way, unlike perhaps other people who are interviewed you, I actually read this book and I really liked it. I'm fascinated by sort of small college athletics, depending on the regardless of sport, I should say. And one of the reasons I am is I went to undergrad in Buffalo, and that city for a long time hosted the D3 college basketball championships, in fact. And when I went there, and this is obviously many years ago, I was kind of blown away by the skill level of the players. The only thing that they didn't have was height. Everything else, though, I mean, they were legit, really, really good basketball players. And going to school up there, I certainly knew about Jeff Van Gundy and his success. I knew actually where he had coached in Rochester prior to reading your book, McQuaid, which is was a well-known basketball school in Western New York. So it was interesting. I really liked it. It was, I thought, really well done. So for those who haven't read the book and for those who don't know much about Division III basketball, how would you describe what you and Ben Kaplan sort of wanted to achieve with this?
So thank you for reading it. Ben played at Amherst, and he told me, he said, did you know that 12 of the 30 teams at the time that he pitched me the story in the NBA, either their head coach or their top basketball decision maker, GM or president of basketball operations, played D3 ball? And I consider myself a pretty in-depth NBA fan. And I was like, I did not know that. I had no idea. He's like, I think that there's a story here, but no one will buy a book about this from me, a data analyst. Maybe they would buy it from us if we partner up with our media, with your media profile. And I was like, honestly, it still seems pretty niche to me. Like, it would need to have some star power attached to it. And he's like, well, how about Greg Popovich and Sam Presti and Jeff Van Gundy and Stan Van Gundy and Brad Stevens? And I'm like, oh my God, like, there's really a thing here. How does this happen? And I think what we wanted to do was explain the value of networking and how when one person kicks down a door and gets in, maybe through dumb luck, people tend to hire people that they know. And all of a sudden, the format can shift of what people look at and expect. Oh, you didn't need to play in the NBA to coach in the NBA. You didn't need to play D1 to relate to the 6'9" wing who can windmill dunk from the free throw line. Coaching is teaching, and these guys at the D3 level pursued basketball for their love of the game. They just weren't ready to give it up after high school. And like you said, it is a very high level, so their knowledge of basketball is incredibly high. But then with that D3 experience comes humility, and it leads to some of the great innovative minds in the sport. So I think basically we wanted to tell the origin stories of these guys that everybody knows their name. Everyone knows they didn't play in the NBA, but there's actually a step-by-step process of how not only that they got to the NBA, but that they brought people behind them. And now there's a legitimate statistical argument that you are just as likely to coach or run an NBA team if you played D3 or D1 basketball. And that is so counterintuitive, I think, but we wanted to tell the story of how it happened.
There's a stat that you guys put out that entering the beginning of this season, there were 6 former Division III players serving as head coaches. So Tom Thibodeau, Steve Clifford, Frank Vogel, Will Hardy, Chris Finch, Wes Unseld Jr. Obviously, with the NBA, things are always going to change given the coaches. We talked, you know, I mentioned the Van Gundys, and I'll get to them in a little bit. But have you found, we'll just use the people who started head coaching at the beginning of this year. Are they stylistically, in your opinion, the same because of their lower college basketball roots, or just given their own individual journeys? Do you feel they're all different? I guess what I'm trying to say is there a through line for being a D3 person versus just their individual kind of coaching philosophies that they picked up given their own individual journeys?
So that's an interesting question. So like Frank Vogel and Tom Thibodeau are very different personalities. You know, so Tibbs is he will outwork the guy that works 24 hours a day somehow. You know, he's a little gruff. He was probably done with coaching after flaming out in Chicago and Minnesota, and Leon Rose gets the Knicks job, former D3 guy, and they have a connection through CAA, you know, of all things, and former D3 guy Leon Rose gets Knicks job having never run the Knicks. He's supposed to recruit big-time free agents. He hires former D3 flame-out coach Tom Thibodeau because of their agency connections. The only big free agent he recruits is the son of his first client, Jalen Brunson, son of Rick Brunson. And it's working. You know, so that's obviously its own thing. And then Frank Vogel is much more of a relationship experiential, I know everything about your family, a joy to talk to type of guy. But what I think the through line is the work ethic and not taking no for an answer and no task being too small. And that well-rounded both education literally from a liberal arts background, but also I've got to rebound for you. I've got to do the laundry. I've got to drive the team to the game. We don't have a home gym, all of those sort of things. It provides a humility for these guys that allows them to really, the players respect the grunt work. There is no entitlement to any of these guys. And I think that more so that is the through line, because personalities are going to be different. Experiences are going to be different. Offensive expertise, defensive expertise, that's going to be different, maybe based on your upbringing, what coach inherited you worked for at the beginning, what assignment you got. But the through line to me is the work ethic and the diversity of skill set, because at that level, there weren't specialists. You had to do everything.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was Pat Riley who said it from your book or that you guys referenced it, but it was, I think he was talking about Jeff Van Gundy, and it was something to the effect of that the players aren't going to care if you didn't play in the NBA, but they want like reliability. They want to see that you're invested. They want you to be consistent. That was interesting to me that, and maybe it's different today, although I doubt it, but like Riley was sort of saying like the modern NBA player like will not care if you weren't like a five-time All-Star, even though obviously in the NBA now we have coaches who were excellent NBA players. I thought that was interesting, and I think that does track. Like Nick Nurse didn't play in the NBA, right? Like you can go down the list of, obviously Van Gundy didn't play in the NBA. Popovich is one of the most successful coaches ever. Yeah, he played in college, but he didn't play at Kentucky or anything like that. So that was interesting. I feel like, if nothing else, these guys have figured out that in some ways the players will respect you if you respect the game.
100%. And, you know, some coaches did talk about getting tested a little bit more, or getting, you got to prove yourself with your mind because you can't prove yourself out on the court doing the drills, even though some of these guys are pretty good. Like, there's a viral video on the internet of Stan Van Gundy doing like a dribble combo drill because players weren't able to participate in a Orlando Magic camp during the lockout. And, you know, all the campers are going nuts and the internet's going nuts and it's on SportsCenter because they don't think that a, you know, overweight, bald white guy can go between the legs and behind the back.
But Stan Van Gundy wasn't always that. He was once a thin, a rail thin college 21-year-old.
Correct, who set a consecutive free throws made record for his school that went over multiple seasons because he was never getting fouled. He was like, yeah, I set the record basically whenever there were technicals or flagrant fouls. But so like that thing of LeBron looks over at the bench, asks what the hand signal is for the other team. I have to know it because that's my value. And if I don't know it and I see LeBron hang his head in disappointment, he might not ask me another question for 2 months because he knows everything. But the one time something surprises him, I have to know it. That's these guys's leg up on the competition. It's between the ears. And the majority of them, to that anecdote that you're referencing, said that the term coach has an inherent respect with these guys. They want to be coached. They want to learn. So as long as they know that you have their best interest, that you're working hard, and that you know your shit, they will listen to you and respect you, but that respect can go away in an instant if you blow it.
Yeah, I actually think LeBron, I don't think he's going to pursue this, but I think he'd actually be a great coach. I think he has the best, great basketball mind.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk. No. You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I want to get into the Van Gundys because they're really, really an important part of this book. I mean, you dedicate a lot of real estate to them. And, you know, Jeff's story in particular is just fascinating in that there's so many places like within Van Gundy's journey where if it sort of went left instead of right, he's not coming close to an NBA coach. He's not ever going to be on the air calling NBA finals. You know what I mean? Like he had success at his high school and sort of the name escapes my mind, but somebody obviously sees sort of, you know, somebody sees how he prepares his team. He's a counselor at one of these camps. Somebody makes sort of a notation that, hey, this is a really good young sort of coach. He's a really good thinker. Eventually gets, you know, introduced to like the Stu Jackson types and the Patino types. It's so it's like it's in his work ethic got him to these places. But in some how do I sort of say this? Sometimes you also have to have luck. Like in some ways, the person, like, how do I say this? The person who discovers your genius has to be in a position where they're in a position to make things happen as well. Do you know what I mean? Like if it's not Stu Jackson, but it's John Smith and John Smith flames out at Coastal Carolina, well, Jeff Van Gundy flames out. But in this case, the right people sort of recognized his work ethic. And I thought it was just really, I thought you guys did a great job, one, of just sort of explaining Van Gundy's story. But two, it really reminds you in some ways that you gotta be, you got to make your own luck and be in a great position to make your own luck. And then sometimes you got to get luck too.
There's so much luck. I mean, Frank Vogel and Brad Stevens randomly met at a park.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like there's so many things like that. You mentioned the Van Gundy story. You know, he just gets noticed working out a high school player. So many of these guys have the humility of like, I would have been happy coaching D3 forever. I thought I was going to coach D3 forever, but I met one person or one person noticed me at a five-star camp in Jersey, and it changed my life forever. And I never would have imagined that I would make millions of dollars and fly on chartered flights and all of that stuff. Van Gundy felt like the only person we could ask to do the foreword of the book because he embodied it. It was the true love of the game. He brought so many people behind him. Stan Van Gundy, Steve Clifford, Andy Greer. Tibbs was in, but obviously he had a huge role in Tibbs' ascension. But also, I mean, this guy went to Yale thinking he was going to play basketball. Then they're like, you're not good enough. We're not even going to let you try out for the team. So he gives up a Yale education to transfer to Menlo Junior College.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Then he transfers to Brockport to play for his dad. Then they fire his dad. Then he transfers to Nazareth. That route, just to follow basketball and then to be principled and to keep playing at whatever level he could, is so incredible. And I mean, the Nazareth stories of him, I mean, he's just a... he's a complete madman. There's a story that I was like, this has to be folklore. I'm like, there's no way this is true. They're playing in a game. It's the end of the first overtime. It's tied. And there's a technical foul. And he runs up to the ref and says, wait. My dad's a coach. I've been in this situation before. The free throws are supposed to be put at the start of the second overtime. And obviously that's not true. And he convinces the refs that they've got to do the free throws at the start of the second overtime. And, you know, they go on to win the game. The ref comes back to him a couple of weeks later and is like, you son of a bitch, I got in so much trouble for that sort of thing. Like, he's just a madman. At one of his first jobs, he said to his best player, he's like, you have to get on the floor. I don't care if you score 30 points, you have to get on the floor for a loose ball. There was an opportunity that he thought came and went where the guy didn't get on the loose floor. He calls a timeout and he just dives across the floor to demonstrate it as the head coach of the team. Like, these guys are just crazy people, but they're teachers. They think that the level that they're at is the best level and they are going to treat it like it's the NBA Finals, even if it's Nazareth. And that is what allows him to coach Patrick Ewing. You know, it's a really remarkable thing.
Well, that's one on this book. And again, people can get this book anywhere, right? Amazon, Goodreads, your local bookstores. Here's what I want to ask you about, and it is specific to the book. This is not going to be a season on the brink or, you know, the Michael Jordan story. Like, this is, you're going to have to hustle to try to get people invested in this book. And I think you've done, I mean, you know, at this point, I feel like this is probably the 78th podcast you've done. Obviously, I see on Twitter/X, you've got all the people who you know in the business to shout it out, which is what you're supposed to do when it comes to this stuff. But when you and Ben sort of sat down to sort of like, once the idea you're going to do and you're doing the research and you're going to write it, like the whole other component is the marketing component of this, the public relations component. And you guys have a tough chore, I think, because this is Division III. You're not, you know, you didn't write a book about Zion Williamson. Do you know what I'm saying? Or the best Division I players of the moment. So this is a process podcast sometimes. So like what was your thought process in terms of, okay, how do I get this? How do I convince people who might be interested in this book to be interested in this book?
Yeah. So we'll see how it ends up going. It seems to be going pretty well so far. You know, we hit number one in sports on Amazon for a little bit. We've been sitting comfortably at two. We've been number one in basketball for a while. I don't know how those algorithms work, if it's just because you went from zero to 10 or
still good though, regardless. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So like I don't want to pretend like this is going to be a New York Times bestseller, but basically I know a lot of people. I've called in a lot of favors, and hopefully I've done a lot of favors for a lot of these people, and it's a true labor of love. So this was Ben's dream project. Ben is my best friend since third grade. Our families are very close. The opportunity to work on something with him was too good to pass up. And then if I could get a little sappy, I almost didn't take on the project. When he pitched it to me, my dad was in a pretty steep decline with Alzheimer's. My brother had just been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And then after we started writing the book, Ben's dad got diagnosed with a rare form of cancer, and all three of them passed away before publication date. So we donate the book to those we lost along the way. I'm donating a portion of every book sold to brain cancer research in honor of my brother, Brad. And it became my passion project. Like, it was a little bit of an escape from having a child and another child along the way and a dying brother and a dying dad. And like, it was nice to work on something with your best friend. And so I'm really proud of just getting it done. Like, I'm just proud of the accomplishment. And I think that we did a really good job. And so whether the only people who bought the book are the people who would get it for free, Ben's mom and my mom, that's kind of okay. Obviously, I want it to sell hundreds of thousands of copies. But the marketing strategy has basically been, I call in all of the favors of the people that I know, and Ben has to activate the D3 community, which is passionate. Like, they love getting recognized. There are D3 blogs and podcasts and websites, you know. Their Twitter accounts have 6,000 followers or 8,000 followers, but hopefully it's a really engaged, you know, fan base. Amherst and Middlebury and Williams and Emerson, we're trying to get them, and some have, some haven't, to put it out to their newsletters and their people and like do the grassroots thing from the D3 world. And then I'm doing the Richard Deitches and Kevin Clarks and Colin Cowherds of the world and the Nick Wrights of the world and doing that sort of thing and trying to do our best. You know, I've got a list. It's actually not next to me right now, but it had about 120 names on it. And I had columns, you know, post, podcast/show. And I'm doing check marks of like, are these people coming through with what they said they were going to come through for, of booking me on their show, doing podcasts, whatever the case may be. Some of the guys who are more colleagues, I maybe get one post and that's amazing. Some of the people that are dear friends, like Adam Lefko, he gets Shaq to take a picture with the book.
I saw that. That was great.
And put it out for me. You know what I mean? Nick Wright, my best friend since college, Ben, my best friend since grade school. They were both groomsmen in my wedding. Like, Nick has connected me with a lot of people and done a lot to help me with this project. And then other people in the media that I don't know as well, some that I do, but that, you know, Chris Broussard played D3 basketball. So he was kind of helpful. Casey Johnson, terrific Bulls beat reporter. I know him well here in Chicago. He played D3 basketball. So he connected me with some people in the NBA to help get interviews and to, hey, tweet about this, publicize this, whatever. Like, that community loves and is really proud of this story. So they're embracing it. And, you know, you work in this industry as long as I have. You go to Syracuse. You have a lot of people on your show to help them promote their project. It's time to call in some favors. And I'm not shy about that.
That was good. That's really well thought out and said. As you're going through the litany of that, I'll tell you somebody who would be really interested in the book, Stars Burke, who's really a basketball wonk and played at Providence, which obviously is a D1 school, but would really, I think, appreciate this book because she was an assistant coach at Providence before she eventually went into television. And
that's a good point. You know, I don't have I got to think about a connection to get it to Doris.
I'll give you something after we're done here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, like, that's very kind of you. I mean, like the top name on the book, Adrian Wojnarowski, you know, I've never met the man, but I'm very good friends with Jeff Passan. And Woj wrote, you know, Miracle St. Anthony's. I mean, it's one of the greatest basketball books ever. One of the best sports books ever. I'm a little obsessed with his old columns and news and notes, you know what I mean, as an NBA person. Yeah. And Passan and I are very close, and he said that he would connect us. No promises were made. And so Woj and I developed a little bit of a text relationship, and he said that he would be happy to read like an early draft of the manuscript. And I was like, he's not going to do that. And like a day and a half later, he had read 7 chapters and said that he loved it and he would be honored to blurb it for us. And I was like, oh my God, that's just that right there. I was like, this project is a success. Woj is going to blurb the book, you know? So, it's been really rewarding to, yes, have to be a little shameless and call in some favors, but then also people to like actually validate the work.
Yeah, that's cool. I appreciate you saying that. All right, let's finish up here. You're in your day-to-day life, your, you know, full-time job, you are a afternoon host in Chicago at a very, very big radio station there. There are still cities, Chicago is one of them, New York, Philly, Boston, you know, maybe LA, a couple others. My apologies if I'm missing out on any, where local sports radio still like matters and matters significantly. It could still make money. It still, I would sort of say, maybe sets the tempo of conversation in a city, especially with newspapers fading and consolidating. At the same time, the industry is, you know, you're not sort of dumb on this. Like, it's a very, very challenging industry. The world, less people driving cars, right? And just, we're just, you know, it's now much more on-demand audio than sort of live audio. So this long rambling question gets to this. As someone who's sort of in the middle of it, like, where's your optimism? Because, you know, you would like to still get, you know, another 20, 25 years, I would imagine, like sort of in this. You clearly love this if you're doing it. But I have seen so many cities, particularly sort of mid-sized cities, where this has just been gutted. You know, people are getting out of the business. So from your perspective, a very, very good job in terms of big city radio. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think about it all the time. I have a 4 and a 2-year-old. I'm 37 years old. I live in a nice house in a nice suburb. You know, I gotta earn for a long time. And I make a good living. My thought is that maybe radio won't be as big of a deal forever. And it clearly is not as big of a deal now as it was when I was interning, you know, my sophomore and junior year of college, and I'm interning for a guy named Dan McNeil at the other radio station at ESPN 1000, and he gets a quarterly bonus that was big enough where he could take the whole show to Hawaii. You know what I mean? Like doing afternoon sports radio in Chicago in, you know, 2007, my exact job now, you know, he was making 2.5x probably what I make now. So it's changed. It's obviously, you know, Pandora and Spotify and iTunes and everything, right? We all know. But it still is really relevant and you can still make a really good living. And my thought is that basically, because it is such a great sports city and there are so many Chicago sports fans, that maybe it won't be radio. But we're on YouTube. We're on Twitch. We're on podcast. That I do think that there will always be a market for, I want to, the Cubs made a trade. I want instant reaction. I'm going to check it out. I want to tune in now. I want to call in now. I want to text in now. And so as long as we evolve, and frankly, radio companies have been painfully slow at this, I do think that, you know, we'll be the last man standing, so to speak, local sports and local news, right? Like, there's no reason, really, and I know my colleagues in music radio don't like this, but why would you listen to censored music on the radio with commercials? There's no reason to do that. But local sports and opinion? I could see not wanting to wait for the podcast to post right when the game ends, right when the trade happens, and having the companion of, you know, I mean, Joe Rogan does 3 hours of podcasts. I do 4 hours a day. You know what I mean? We're with people who are just in and out of their cars, driving around, doing their thing at their cubicle. So I do think that we'll be last man standing, but I obviously think that our market share is going to continue to decrease. So we need to increase our market share on the digital side with investment in social media, YouTube, podcasts, things like that.
All right, last two. When you are doing your No, it's good. It's podcast. It's infinite space here.
Yeah.
And I ask long questions, so trust me. They'll be more mad at me than you. You know, something that's interesting to me in your position is that I wonder, do you think about, like, do you feel you're competing with national sports talk hosts in addition to whoever else is on at a competing radio station in Chicago? Because it's sort of an interesting, and maybe the right answer is you're competing with everybody, but, like, do you feel like you're competing with whatever? Name your Dan Patrick. Name your national sports talk host as someone who the Chicago consumer can choose you if they want local or choose a national, but you could also be national too, right? So, like, that's sort of what's interesting to me. How do you see that? How do you see the nationally branded shows versus yours?
I think that the national shows serve an obvious purpose and a lot of really talented people work on them. The truth is that people have choices for entertainment. There are only so many hours in a day. So I do think, to your caveat in your question, like, I'm competing with everybody. How many hours a day can someone listen to sports content? I'm competing in, for that sense, with Pardon My Take and Colin Cowherd and The Lebatard Show and Pat McAfee and everyone in between, because even if I'm not on at the same time as McAfee, you can listen to it on demand, to your point. So in that sense, I am competing with it. I'm also thinking that I'm competing with, okay, Caleb Williams is going to be a national story. I better be an authority figure on that. Like, if Colin Cowherd has a better Caleb Williams take than me, that is going to bother me. Like, I'm competitive on, like, the subjective nature of, is someone having a better take on my thing? That I want to be so damn sure in the industry's mind that I'm the guy on that sort of thing, that they want to bring me onto their shows. So that's, like, my own personal competitiveness with it. But in terms of, you know, ratings or, like, how I think about the show or anything like that, no, it's do the best show possible, have the most people listen to it in Chicago and on demand as possible, and go from there. But from, like, a practicality standpoint, that people can listen to anything, and a content standpoint, yeah, I think about what those guys are doing all the time.
Last one for me. Do you think there is a certain style that you have to do because you are in Chicago versus, let's say, if I flip my fingers and you're in Philly tomorrow or in New York? I lived in New York, so I have a really good feel for New York City sports talk. And I'm someone who's kind of a radio junkie, so I've listened around the country. I lived in Michigan for a little bit, so I, you know, I have a feel for some of the Midwest. But, you know, this is your business. I'm sure you listen to local people all over if you're sort of similar to me.
Yep.
So do you think, like, is there a certain style that Chicago sports radio has versus any other major city? And if it is unique, how would you define it, or how would you define its uniqueness?
Well, so I would say that Chicago is the best city in the world. I'm obviously biased, but of the four cities that you mentioned, New York, Philly, Boston, Chicago, as like where sports talk matters, Chicago is probably, if I'm being totally candid, fourth. I look at us as like the captain of everybody else. New York, Philly, and Boston have a bit of a meanness to it.
I agree. Yeah.
That Chicago doesn't have in its day to day. Like, we can be tough and we can have confrontational interviews, and I have adversarial relationships with coaches and managers and teams. And you know what I mean? Like, I look at it like that. I have like the rant or the sharp edge interview in my bag, but it's not every club. And that sounds like I'm being judgmental to those other markets. And in some ways, maybe it is. But I want to do a bunch of stuff where we're laughing and do a bunch of stuff where we're like appreciating the sports and complimenting the teams and like purely enjoying the entertainment aspect of it, or doing a biographical interview to get to know the person on the team, you know, and as opposed to monologue, negativity sells, take calls.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think you've hit on something. Meanness, maybe, again, as a New Yorker, I'm probably a little biased here. What all those cities have is edge. And I think this is just my take. The hosts, in many ways, attempt to reflect the fan base by then throwing the edge back. But the edge that the host will throw back is going to be amplified to like a certain level. Do you know what I'm saying? Where it then does sound more mean. And I agree with you. I have found, I've been on Chicago Airwaves many, many times. I find I'm having more of a conversation with the hosts, a back and forth, than anything else, where when I'm on those other markets, I feel like instinctively I'm being asked to give a take, and quite frankly, usually like a take with some bite and some edge.
Yeah, and again, like I went to school at Syracuse. I listened to Mike and the Mad Dog. I think with the numbers that they get in Boston are unbelievable. Like, they're doing it because it works and they make a ton of money, and I could do it. This is a provincial business. I think that there is some, like, you got to be from here and that sort of thing. So I think it would be, I definitely have a higher ceiling in Chicago than I do in Boston as a radio host. But I obviously could do it. I just personally don't find it as interesting to do it that way. I'd much rather, if Danny's pissed about something, he's pissed about something. And it's genuine, and it's that's worth him getting upset about, or raising his voice, or yelling, or whatever the case may be. I can't do that every day or even every week. It comes across as phony to me. And I mean, come on, it's a baseball game in April. I'm gonna call for the guy to get fired. That's ridiculous. Like, there's another game tomorrow.
Yeah, I think you'd find Canadian sports talk interesting because it's very, very different than anything in America. Danny Parkins is the co-author of Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. He wrote that with, as he mentioned this interview, his best friend Ben Kaplan. He's also the co-host of The Score 670's Chicago, 670 I should say, there's no plural there, their afternoon show with Matt Spiegel. Obviously, it's a very, very well-known show in Chicago, but also obviously anybody who's a fan of Chicago sports would check that out. That's one of the great things about the world today with the web, is you can be in Auckland, New Zealand, and listen to Danny's show live. Danny, man, I wish you the best of luck with this. You guys really, first, you wrote a really terrific book, and it's so clear how much research and how much passion that you put into it. So it doesn't surprise me that it's doing well at all. It's really well done. And I don't say that for every guest, but I'm saying that here. I wish you the best of luck with everything, and thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Richard, man, thank you for the work that you do, man. It's awesome, the light that you shine on the industry, and I appreciate you having me on. Thank you, sir.
You got it. All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Danny for coming on. I wish him the best of luck with his book. Head to the archives if you want to listen to similar conversations. Andrew Marsham was on this podcast last week. We went 68 minutes on all sorts of sports media stuff. James Andrew Miller was on. Flora Kelly, ESPN data strategist. Had a lot of stuff on Caitlin Clark, obviously. Becky Lynch was on this podcast not too long ago. Jack McCallum. Again, head to the archives. There should be some stuff you like. What else? Of course, I got to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Did a lot of podcasts last week, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you to everybody at Odyssey for your support, and thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.